Members, ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. It's 10:03. This meeting is scheduled for 10 o'clock. The channel is at 11 for the chief meeting. Bandi is coming, Akati is coming, Hasmen is not here. She's at the judicial something commission. And Manella's secretary is not answering telephones. I don't them. Where's the apologies? Just came through. Chantel. Because Manny is on the other week. Yeah, she's also there. He just noticed. Machine, I haven't seen him today. I don't know where he is. Mrs. Arns, can you please try and contact Mr. Honorable Mishile? Just see where he is, please. Remember, sir, you can shift up this way. Honorable Becker, Honorable Lees. Oh, yes. Yeah, I'll mention something special for this committee when they arrive, that we started 2012. But honourable members, welcome at this meeting of the Select Committee for Finance. In terms of the program, this is the last meeting of the Select Committee for Finance for 2012. Appropriations will still meet on the 27th. I will say something at the end of today's two sessions on that. Today we are dealing with a briefing by National Treasury on the credit rating services bill, as well as the financial markets bill. The two bills in front of us, that will be the first session. We'll ask our questions and we'll go to the minutes that we have to consider. The second part of the meeting will be when the ministerial task team on the COPO will join us, still in a cabinet meeting. We received apologies from Honorable Mamela and Honorable Hasmeni, who is busy at the Magistrates Commission in interviews for judges until the 30th of November. So they are at that meeting, they serve on that committee, as well as Honorable Bagati and Honorable Pat Sabandi, that will join us for the second part of today's session. Being chairpersons of the Select Committee for Public Administration and Public Service and the Select Committee for Education, referring to their specific fields and subjects they are dealing with as chairpersons. So with those words, welcome. The team here from Treasury, please introduce yourself and then you can kick off with your presentation to take us through.
Thank you very much, Chair. I've been asked also to please send the apologies of the DG and the DG. They are unfortunately involved in the preparations and supporting the Minister of the Cabinet meeting, so they're not able to attend to the session this morning. How long do we have for the two bills? Can I have no problem? Just to introduce the delegation, my name is Roy Hoffman. I'm the Chief Director of Financial Markets and Stability at the Treasury. My colleague to the left is Brigida Sassali, she is Deputy Director of Financial Market. And my colleague to the far left is Jeanine Bednar-Giordi, she is Director of Legal Services, particularly Financial Regulation in the Office of the Director General.
Thank you, Legal Services. Sorry to interrupt you. There's a good lady sitting there at the back, the State Law Advisor. So welcome to you as well.
Yes, we have a...
And the gentleman next door, who is that? Also State Law Advisor. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Yes, we've walked a long journey with these two bulls with the 2 days old spices. I think they're quite pleased to be here. So I'll be quite quick in terms of the two presentations, just to go through the two bulls. I think we'll begin with the credit rating services bill, as you suggested, and just to take you through where we are with the bill at the moment. So the structure of the presentation is we're just going to go through the background to the bill, why are we doing it, some key issues that have come up over the past year or so, particularly in the comment period we have had for stakeholders, and then following that, some issues that arose in the Standing Committee on Finance and some of the changes that we've made to build during that process, and then some of the comments that came up in the National Assembly about 2 weeks ago, and just some other issues related to the bill. So the purpose of the bill is to introduce new legislation which provides for the registration of credit rating agencies, for the control of certain activities related to those agencies, conditions around the issuance, and the rules of the on the organization and conduct of credit rating agencies, and in all matters connected therewith. The reference points to this bill have been particularly around the financial crisis and the G20. It is one of the requirements from the G20, so the President signed a commitment with other G20 countries for a range of reforms to the financial sector, and we will, through the course of the next year or two, be bringing quite a lot of legislation to the House regarding these G20 commitments. But one of these commitments is to register and to create a regulatory framework for credit rating agencies. In addition, an organization called the International Organization of Securities Commissions has also put out a statement of principles regarding the activities of credit rating agencies, and we as a country are a member of IOSCO, and we are required to adopt the principles at international level, and then there are also other jurisdictions in the European Union, the US and Australia, which have brought out credit rating agency requirements. You've probably heard about the Dodd-Frank piece of legislation, which is in the United States, that has a framework for registering credit rating agencies. I mean, in particular the European Union, if our companies want to sell debt or equity in the European Union, they have to be they have to have a credit rating from a registered credit rating agency, and so the only way that they can do this is either to get a rating in the European Union from an EU agency, or to get a rating from a South African credit rating agency. But if they get from a South African credit rating agency, then that has to be regulated in an equivalent way to how it is regulated in the European Union. I'll explain that in a little bit more detail later. So we basically, this bill essentially introduces a framework for regulating credit rating agencies in South Africa, which is very similar to the regulatory frameworks that have been introduced in the other jurisdictions. So to go back to why we're doing this, credit rating agencies, and when we talk about credit rating agencies, we're talking about Standard & Poor's, Moody's and Fitch, and what they do basically is they provide an opinion on whether or not a company or a country or any kind of institution, but usually a company or a country, can repay its debt. So that's basically their job in the financial system. And there's been a lot of concern about their role during the global financial crisis. Lehman Brothers, which basically was the spark that created the whole crisis, one of the sparks, it was AAA rated until nearly the point of its collapse. So the credit rating agency basically said that Lehman Brothers would be able to repay its debt almost until the day that it collapsed. This suggests that the rating agency wasn't following proper procedures. It may not have had the correct models or the methodologies, appropriate methodologies to rate Lehman Brothers. And so the G20 then thought, well, it's very important that we create a global framework to ensure that rating agencies behave appropriately in terms of how they rate instruments. Also, we've seen that credit rating agencies have to some extent exacerbated the current Eurozone debt crisis. So some credit rating agencies, for example, have downgraded countries that are actually able to repay their debts, and in other cases they haven't downgraded countries. But one of the concerns has been that many countries aren't clear on what is the methodology that these rating agencies have taken, how have they come to these decisions. And so the European Union has introduced legislation that requires rating agencies to explain how they go about doing their business and basically to be more transparent. And it's very important we're not telling rating agencies what to do, we're only asking them to be more transparent. And then there are issues around procyclicality of credit ratings. What that means is that ratings improve as the economy gets better and better, and when the economy starts deteriorating, ratings start getting cut very, very quickly, and that can actually almost create a crisis itself. And then there are major conflicts of interest with some rating agencies. So there's evidence that some ratings agencies provide consultancy services as well as rating services. So, for example, one of the ratings agencies has been accused in the United States and South Africa, has been accused of assisting companies to get a AAA rating. So they provide them with consultancy services to help that, and then they happen to give them a AAA rating when the rating has to be assessed. So there's major conflicts of interest. So it's very important that we create regulation for this. And then, as I said, the G20 commitments are there. Let's give you a broad background why we brought the bill forward. Then the key issues relating to the bill are specifically around jurisdiction and application, and then there's an enormous amount of discussion about liability, and I'll just go through those in some more detail. Now, the problem with rating agencies is that they operate globally, so they're sort of true multinationals, and they offer different services in different jurisdictions. For example, one of them, when they do their ratings on banks, the whole team is actually based in Cyprus. And when they do ratings on insurance companies, the whole business and all the ratings analysts are based in France. So they're actually rating South African banks and South African insurance companies. So it's very important, basically, that we have it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle, that the system that we use to regulate rating agencies is the same as it is in Cyprus and it is in France and in the USA where they are headquartered. So that the ratings that come out of any part of this institution can be used in South Africa. And so the key challenge then is to create a framework where the regulation will have teeth. So we have to be able to regulate together with everybody else. So obviously we as a country can only regulate what takes place in South Africa. And this has led to quite a lot of discussion between the ratings agencies and within ourselves, between us and the Financial Services Board who will be regulating. But essentially what we have proposed to do is Section 4, which says that if you as a regulated person use ratings for regulatory purposes, then you must use ratings that are either, number one, issued or endorsed by ratings agencies which are registered in accordance with the Act. So those are ratings that are generated by a rating agency in South Africa and registered under the South African law. Or you can use a rating that is issued by an external credit rating, that is a rating agency that's not based in South Africa, but then that external credit rating agency has to approve by the Registrar of Credit Ratings. So just to explain some of the concepts there, the regulated person is defined in the Act as being a bank or an insurance company or a pension company, and an external credit rating agency is defined as being the rating agency which is subject to similar laws as those in the Republic. And so this is basically, this approach is modeled on what has happened in the European Union, and so this effectively applies to the Baxter Act, to the Pension Funds Act, and to the Unit Trust Collective Investment Schemes Control Act. But this doesn't mean that you have to use a rating. You have to use rating only if you are only required to use a registered credit rating if you use that for regulatory purposes. It's very important. We are not saying that a pension fund should use ratings. We are saying that they should use ratings where the law requires them to use ratings. Because often what happens is that pension funds get a little bit lazy and they look at a ratings agency and the rating agency says this thing is AAA. And they don't actually do their own research into the investment that they're doing on behalf of pensioners. And then something goes wrong, and then they sort of think, well, it's probably the rating agency's fault, but in many ways it's also a bit of both. And that's quite important on the liability issue. But I'm not sure if we want to take questions as we go, or if we want to keep questions in hand. Okay. No problem? Okay. So that's the one approach. We've also then introduced another approach, which is to allow ratings agencies which are registered in South Africa to endorse ratings from entities in other countries. Because it would be counterproductive to require credit rating agencies to perform all of its activities in South Africa. And the key strength of all the global agencies is that they're able to specialize and have centers of excellence in ratings around the world. So we've introduced an additional concept which it turns out has been quite contentious for some people, but I think it actually makes it easier for credit rating agencies to utilize their skills around the world and still be subject to South African law. So if a ratings agency uses, so let's go back to that slide. Let's take, for example, a rating on a South African bank that is done by an institution in Cyprus. That rating cannot be used by a South African bank because the rating has been written and published in Cyprus. So we have to have some way of allowing, let's say, Moody's in South Africa to kind of stamp that rating and say, no, we think that rating has been issued by one of our companies in our group, and that can be used by a pension bank in South Africa. So we have to create some kind of framework in the law that allows a rating agency that's registered in South Africa to kind of step in and we call it endorse a rating that created in another jurisdiction for use in South Africa. And that's basically what the concept of endorsement is. So if a legal entity endorses a rating, and the legal entity can only be a credit rating that's registered in South Africa, then the ratings may be used for South African regulatory purposes. But importantly, and this is where the contention has been, the agency is liable for any claims that arise as a result of that rating. So they're both taking on, they're both stamping it, and they're also taking potential liability. And this has been quite contentious. But we have felt, and we've issued quite a few responses to the industry, that generally when you buy a rating from Moody's, you don't actually care where in the world it's made. You want to still be able to hold the South African part of Moody's liable. And you can think of it as sort of like a car. When you buy a Ford from a Ford dealership in South Africa and it breaks down, you want to take it back to the Ford office in South Africa for it to be fixed. So, in essence, the Ford company in South Africa is liable for this brand because it's its brand. So we've allowed for this concept of endorsement, which is basically, to be honest, exactly the same as the approach as it comes from the legislation of the European Union. So that created quite a lot of flexibility in the system, but it also means that there's also liability. Then we've had quite a lot of discussion in the committee with both ourselves. We had a drafting committee, and we got external legal opinion, and then the standing committee had a lot of discussion on this. And we thought, what kind of liability regime would we like to have for credit rating agencies? And we considered all the possibilities, and we, in this very room, I think we debated it two or three times. And in the end, we felt that the best approach would be a common law liability. And so in the bill, you will see that the common law liability provisions apply. And we thought that was very important because there's well-established case law on grounds for culpability, liability. Obviously, there are things like negligence, maliciousness, etc. And the courts have been very good at building a whole framework for principles of restitution. There was an initial draft of the bill a clause that said that credit rating agencies cannot contract out of their liability. After a lot of discussion with the committee, and we also got external legal opinion both from the parliamentary legal advisor from our own independent firm, and our discussions in the committee, it was felt that the common law is actually developed far enough that we don't need to entrench that in the legislation. So basically all we did in the legislation is that the common law applies. It's very important just to create that framework. There's obviously been a lot of discussion about whether or not it's appropriate for legislation to entrench the common law, and the parliamentary legal advisor advised that the promotion of the Administrative Justice Act essentially does that. And so there is precedent in that instance, but I think that is the purpose of the section. So I think those are the two major issues that were in the bill. Now I'll deal with some other issues that the bill looks at, and those are things like investor protection, the integrity and independence of the credit rating agencies, the transparency and the accountability. So as I said, we need to ensure that they're transparent, that they're accountable, they have integrity in the way that they do their business, and that they're independent. So I'll quickly often to show you where the bill this appears, but essentially the investor protection requirements are that ratings are defined, reviewed, and updated in a timely and non-selective manner. The ratings agency should not publish a rating that's not possible, that they don't have enough information available to them. They must communicate with the investor and the public questions, concerns, and complaints. They must improve the disclosure information to regulators in the market, etc., etc. So there are quite a few requirements that are basically just to ensure that they provide enough information to people that they're rating. And these sections are almost directly from the European legislation. Then I spoke earlier about conflicts of interest and independence, and it's important that credit rating agencies are arranged in a way that their business interests do not impair their independence. So there are quite a lot of criteria in the bill that aim to achieve that. I'm going to go through all the details, but most importantly, there is a section in the bill that says that the minister and the registrar cannot interfere in the decision that they take. They are independent in what they say, but it's the protest that we're worried about. And that has been gone through quite a lot of discussion in all the different committees. And then there's also about transparency and accountability things. I'm not going to go through these in detail, but there are things that records have to be kept for 5 years, etc., etc. If there are questions, I can go into more of the details here. So then, Chair, if we could just have a look at the bill. I think you have a copy of the bill. If we just have a look at it so that I can just explain it in a little bit of detail in terms of what the bill contains from that presentation. So Chapter 1 deals with the definition of different applications as always. Chapter 2 deals with the registration and licensing requirements of credit rating agencies how they must apply, the sorts of requirements they need in their application. Chapter 3 deals with the duties of the rating agencies, things like the appointment of directors, the way they do their methodologies, etc. And Chapter 4 is the endorsement thing, as I've indicated. And then Chapter 5 deals with their liability requirements. And then Section 20 on Chapter 5 is that section I was speaking about in terms of keeping their independence. And then Chapter 6 deals with just administrative issues around the registrar, who the registrar is, what his powers are, what he can do. And then Chapter 7 deals with the source of enforcement actions that can be taken. And these are essentially the same processes that we use in all of our legislation. And then Chapter 8 just deals with the usual things around providing for regulations, transition arrangements, savings of rights, and the short title and commencement of the bill. So, Chair, I'm aware of the time constraints, so hopefully that has been the...
No problem. We've got the space. Actually, the memorandum is at the back of the bill. That's actually very easy to read, which I recommend to the members as well. Honourable members, are there any questions on this presentation? Let me take your hands, Honourable Kubela. Yes, Honourable Mash. It was distributed quite a while ago. But Mr. Winter will give the member a copy. Any other hands? Honourable Mashile? Yeah, Mashile. Honourable Makubela, you may start.
Thank you, Chairperson. on slide number 7, that's the two bullets there. The challenge is to create a framework where the regulation will have teeth without extraterritorial powers. How can that thing work? Because if you want things to work, you must have the power within that territory. Then number two, one of the major challenges with the rating agencies is all the standardization of their scope assessment. Now my question is, how will this bill address or respond to this. Another question there. On slide number, just take bullet number one, the question I asked on bullet number one on slide number seven, and you come to slide number eight, the second bullet. I don't get, will you bring the clarity there? That will have to meet the following requirements. Is that something, so just to explain more clear. When you started, you said, financial crisis and G20 outcomes. Now tell me, what prompted the establishment of this G20? Can you tell us broadly? Thank you.
Lots of apologies for not actually starting with the presentation. And probably I may have missed the crucial points on the presentation, especially in relation to, in a nutshell, what is this? What are we trying to do? In a nutshell, narrative for politicians, not for technocrats. Why this? And then also I've heard you, because when I arrived here, I think you were talking about what actually prompted this particular piece of legislation. But you have technically tried to avoid raising the question that our own minister has been having problems with the downgrading of the country. You have been technically trying to avoid that. And one would actually want to know whether that is not really, this is not really a response to that specific issue. Because all of us, of course, we are worried, I think, especially the finance family. We thought that we are still on track, we are having our hands on deck, and but these credit ratings from outside our borders then behave differently. And now, the other issue is, my biggest problem is when you have got more than one credit rating agencies, and then they produce their own ratings for the same institution, then they rate it differently. And if they rate it differently, probably there will be one of them who will be disadvantaging the institution by the rating. And if I think there is a comment here which is very brief, and I really need more clarity on it. If any particular investor relies on the worst credit rating and disadvantages that particular institution, when there are other ratings that are actually positive about the institution, does the institution have any recourse? Does it have any recourse? And what would be the limit of the recourse? The second question is the endorsement. Are we talking about an endorsement that has to happen every time when credit ratings are issued or published? And then the local agency must endorse that. Or are we talking about a memorandum of agreement or whatever that says this particular local office will always endorse or support the ratings of its mother agency in Canada? What sort of endorsement? Because I'm a little bit worried if it is going to be a typical online endorsement. That means there will be some gray areas in between where nobody knows whether they are endorsing until that particular endorsement actually gets done. What sort of endorsement are we really talking about? And now, the other issue here, I think it would be for, say, ESCOM. If ESCOM is downgraded because of a particular incident or reason, and then ESCOM thinks that they have actually dealt with the problem, and then they want a re-reading how is it supposed to go about? Do institutions have any influence for them to be re-rated, or they just have to wait for these credit rating agencies when they are happy and they've had a nice sleep and then decide to re-rate them? What sort of influence do we have? Do we have credit rating agencies in the country that are independent themselves? Or are we at the mercy of the Western credit ratings, Standard and Poor's, the Fitch and the Moody's? And if one is established in the country, or let me say, this particular deal that this will provide for an establishment of a credit rating agency, other than just simply regulating, will it provide for the establishment of these particular credit rating agencies? Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the team. We've dealt with the bill and the legislation. Has any work been done on the implementation? How long it will actually become a working document? In other words, be enforceable? The office be opened and staffed, and what the costs are going to be, all that kind of practical stuff, or is that left to someone else to deal with and not to yourself? Because, yeah, it's not much use if it's not, there's no one to enforce it. I know it'll fall under the FSB, but has budget been made available?
Any other questions?
Yeah, I think the last one is that this particular bill provides for a credit rating agency in the country, which is not actually an extension of an existing credit rating agency in another country, endorse ratings of a particular agency outside the country. Like if I create my own credit rating agency and then I have decided to actually endorse ratings of Standard & Poor's. Is that possible? Will that be allowed? And is it provided? If not, what are the limitations and how can we actually get around that? Thanks.
Thank you, honorable members. Mr. Altman, you and your team can respond on this one.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to go to the first question, which related to the first bullet on slide 7. Yes, I think that is a very good question because as a country, we can obviously not regulate the activities of institutions that operate outside of the borders of South Africa. So we do not have the power to regulate ratings agencies if they operate in another jurisdiction outside. So one must be very careful in creating the legislation, and this has taken us quite a lot of thinking, to stop having these outside of our territory powers, whereas actually other countries have sort of accidentally imposed their regulations on us. So it's a very strange, like, jigsaw puzzle of trying to make sure we all have very similar legislation but not regulate each other. And in actual fact, there are concerns that we have with our friends around the fact that not ratings agencies, but in other parts of regulation, and I'll discuss it in the next book actually, where requirements from particularly the United States and the Dodd-Frank have got dictatorial implications on South Africa. And so that is a bit of a problem. But we've tried in this book, we've done it to our best, and we've engaged the G20 actually on the extraterritorial issue. Then there was a question on the standardization of scope assessment. I assume what you mean by that question is that the rating agencies use standard approaches to rating different countries and that they don't take into account specific issues in particular countries. That is a concern. I do think that particularly the
new legislation in the European Union, where most of the ratings agencies are based, will help a lot in terms of ensuring that when they do rate us, that they do apply their mind better to specific issues that are in South Africa. When I get to this very good question of the data, I will deal with the data in a bit more detail. Then I think there was a question on clarity with regards to the requirements. This is in connection, I think, with the extraterritoriality issue. All we're saying here is that you can operate in South Africa if we are happy that another regulator regulates you in the same way as we do. It is, you're quite correct, it comes close to extraterritoriality, but it's not quite. So we hope that it's enough. And then the question on the G20 is a very interesting one. Following the G20 has existed for a very long time, actually. It's existed for I think, over 10 or 15 years. We actually hosted the G20 finance ministers and governors meeting here in South Africa. I think it was in 2006 or 2005. We have chaired the G20 at some point in its history. And the G20 was always quite a nice organization for coordinating the 20 largest countries in the world. But then after the global financial crisis, and particularly under the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown, it got a new life of its own. And it really started dealing more specifically with financial regulatory issues. And I think it's actually been a very, very useful forum. We find it incredibly useful, although it does require quite a lot of travel. We have a whole team that deals at the Treasury with the G20 because it's a Treasury responsibility to deal with the finance ministers and governors track. And then there's also a heads of state part now, which is a new thing, which Gordon Brown introduced. So previously the G20 was just for finance ministers and governors. Now it's also for heads of state. So the president goes at least twice a year. And we're finding it very, very useful for him, particularly because previously the G8, which was the rich countries, would make decisions and we wouldn't have a voice in those forums. And now the G20 includes us and includes other emerging markets like Mexico and Brazil and China. And I think that's very useful. In terms of Honorable Sheedy's question, in terms of the national, what are we trying to do? I think that hopefully summarizes the best. Well, all we're really trying to do is create a framework to register credit rating agencies to ensure they're transparent and that they do things in an appropriate way and that they are operating in South Africa under similar rules to how they operate internationally. Your second question, this is just a response to the downgrade. This is not just a response to that, and I can prove that because this question has come up a lot by saying we actually began drafting an international legislation just after we'd received an upgrade, I think, or after an upgrade. And so this legislation has been quite a long time in the creation. However, the downgrade has highlighted that the ratings agencies do need to internationally, and particularly one of the two downgrades, it does appear that it didn't necessarily follow all the process, but there are regulations in place for that. Then, if more than one agency rates you differently, are you disadvantaged? And if you're running worse, there's recourse. The bill does say that you really need to look after yourself to some extent. So you can't only rely on one agency. I think it's in section 3, 4, where it basically says that you must take into account not only one agency in making a decision. So you do need to look after yourself in that regard. Question, is there endorsement every single time? It's a very good question because previously the bill accidentally didn't have a plural for credit rating agents ratings, and we have now made a plural. And in actual fact, we require the registrar to maintain a list of the agencies that can be endorsed on his website. So there's complete transparency about which ratings you can endorse, etc. So hopefully it will make it quite a lot easier. If ECHM is downgraded, can it ask to be rated again? Yes, they can. They are, the ratings agency is actually, they're a client of the ratings agency. So there are two types of ratings, let me do it another way. There are two types of ratings. There are ratings where you've actually asked for it, and there are ratings where they do it without being asked for it, and they call them solicited and unsolicited ratings. If it is solicited rating, so you have requested the rating from the rating agency, then it is completely within your rights to request that they redo the rating after new financial information has come out. So that is actually, I think, covered under the contract that they have. And then a very, very important question is exactly one of the reasons why we're doing this legislation is because if we're going to have South African ratings agencies and they want to operate in South Africa and Africa and even Europe, then they have to be regulated in the same way Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch are regulated. And this bill actually allows them to be registered in South Africa and be regulated in the same way as they are around the world. So this will actually create the space for us to have regulated South African credit rating agencies. And currently we have two that are interested in applying. One of them has been operational in South Africa for quite a long time, and the other one has been from time to time. So this will allow them the opportunity to register and get their house in order so that they are able to compete with global ratings agencies. So it does actually help us develop our own ratings agencies environment. It's called Credit Ratings Africa, Ratings Africa, and the other one is, I think, Credit Ratings Service or something. Global Ratings is what they call themselves. And then the final question, then the final question was from Honourable Lee. I've done his question first. Yes, we have actually really employed a manager or a senior manager in a financial services board. The office has been set up. He is actually a former person from Fitch Ratings, so we've kind of both poacher turned gamekeeper, and he's already given us a lot of insight into certain issues. So the office has been set up, and it's actually really begun doing its work. It has put out the required rules, etc. So it will be up and running as soon as the bill is passed. So I hope that covers all the questions. Oh, which one?
The crucial to me is whether the a local like this global rating can endorse Standard & Poor's rating. Is that possible?
No, that unfortunately it's not possible. It can only endorse a rating from a company that is in the same group as it. We felt that it would be create too much risk both ways, so it's not.
Chairman, just a quick comment. I mean, it's encouraging at the speed at which this office has been set up, but somewhat astonishing that it's set up before the bill becomes an act. So I don't know in what terms of what legislation this office has been set up and people employed, but I think that's probably not a bad thing, given the length of time, for instance, the budget office has taken to be set up and still isn't properly set up a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the individual doesn't have any powers under the law, but because there will be rules and there will have to be a framework, those he has had to develop, and he's actually put them out of consultation already. So he's just been employed by the Financial Services Board as an expert in the area, and then he will be appointed under when that is passed.
Thanks, Chairperson. Since we're having difference between a delict and a crime,
yes.
I'm saying here,
yes.
You are saying, well-established case law on the grounds of liability, that is negligent, malicious, that is normal rule of intellectual capability. What will be the case on the criminal capability?
Yes, that's an issue that came up quite a lot. Section 32 in the bill establishes what components will be criminal, and that is if you fail to comply with Section 3.2, which is that essentially you operate unregistered. 32B, deliberately make a misleading, false, deceptive statement or conceals any material fact, so that is fraud. In the execution of duties imposed by the Act, gives an order to a compliance officer information which is false, also, and then those are the criminal offences that the bill creates, and the rest are civil offences.
Sorry. We combine us with tomorrow's plenary. There's some confusion. That work has already been done. Please,
Thank you, Chair. This is probably one of the longest in development pieces of legislation, and it is essentially an update of the Security Services Act, which is now increasingly old because global financial markets have moved substantially. So the Security Services Act came out before the global financial crisis, and as a result of our G20 requirements, we need to update our security legislation, and the Financial Markets Bill attempts to do that. And this is part of a broader approach to our overall upgrading of legislation. We are shifting different peaks, and we will come and explain that next year when the legislation is being developed. But we also have strengthened our approach to regulation quite significantly across a whole range of different areas. You will hopefully early next year also be doing with the Financial Services General Laws Amendment Bill, which explains the Credit Rating Services Bill, and this is the Financial Markets Bill. And there are also new banking regulations. So this is quite a monster of a bill. It is both a very big bill and a very small bill. It's a strange thing to say, because it was originally an amendment bill. So it originally went to the Security Services Act and amended different chunks of it. However, as I'm sure you all know, an amendment bill is a horrible thing. And so what we did is, rather than having an amendment bill, we just bought a new bill. And we will explain what we've actually amended. So it looks like a really big piece of legislation, but in reality, it is not as big as it looks. And we've also renamed it, so it used to be the Security Services Act, and so the original bill was called the Security Services Act Amendment Bill. This is now called the Financial Markets Act. That's just for a simpler name, because it's slightly more dense than the Security Services Act. So I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through this in too much detail, but essentially capital markets are very, very important in terms of how they convert savings into growth. So the financial markets are the way in which savings are created into investment. And that mainly takes place through the capital markets, and also it's also the key way that pension funds can invest in the system. So they invest in equities, they invest in bonds. All of those have to be regulated. And this is what the Security Services Act has done, and now the upgrade Financial Markets Act has done. This makes the point, the red is the extent of savings that goes into the system. I think we're trying to make that point again in this much nicer picture, I think. And then just highlighting that obviously we as a country are very fortunate in that we have extremely deep and liquid capital markets relative to other jurisdictions. On the right-hand side, our equity to GDP ratio is 144%, which is slightly a function of the fact that we have very high equity to debt markets. But we are very fortunate that we have a very well-regulated system. The JSE is regarded as one of the best best exchanges in the world. And so this bill really is a continuum of our never-ending kind of upgrading to regulation in financial markets. And there I've just highlighted that our regulatory framework is very strong. That first, for frequency of banking crisis, doesn't mean that we have the most banking crises of any other jurisdiction. It means we have the least. So we come out best in terms of frequency of banking crisis, which is actually quite amazing considering that in the last 15 years we've actually experienced 3 bank losses, Samba being the biggest one. But we are still the best in the world when it comes to banking crisis. We're the best in the world when it comes to securities exchanges, and in auditing and reporting, and we're second best in the summons of our banks. I think first best is Canada, and board, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, as you all know, at the bottom of the list, we unfortunately don't do so well in terms of affordability and ease of access to loans and venture capital availability, and that is part of our set of reforms which we are bringing forward next year to improve, and I'm sure you've heard the Minister. It's one of his pet topics, which is the cost of financial services. Yes. So it is a major issue for him, and a major issue as a result of that, but that's not being dealt with in this bill. So as I said, it updates the Security Services Act, mainly by aligning it with international developments. So we have a number of G20 commitments following the global financial crisis. We are a member of an organization called the Financial Stability Board. They have also made recommendations to the international body. As I highlighted earlier, we're also a member of the International Organization of Securities Commissioners, They have made a number of recommendations. Then we every 5 years we get assessed comprehensively by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in terms of how we're doing relative to other countries, and we get assessed on those things, and they make they highlight particular points on where they think we can improve our legislation, and we have a lot of engagement with them, and we disagree on some things, and we don't do what we don't like, they say, if we don't do it. No. We've tried as far as possible to incorporate the international best standards practice. And then we're also a member of UNIDROIT Convention, it's an international convention on insolvency. And then there are a lot of other technical issues. So as I said, these are just sort of updates to the Security Services Act as a result of these things. And this bill, as I said, has been enormously long in the making. We had a 2-year review process of the Security Services Act. We have a policy to review our major pieces of legislation every 5 years. And so we do them stepwise by stepwise. So the next piece of legislation you will deal with is the Financial Services General Amendment Bill, which amends some of the other legislation, and then there will also be a Banks Amendment Bill. So we basically, every 5 years, bring a bill through Parliament to update our legislative framework. And this is then the update. So it's been a long time in making. We published the bill in August 2011. We took a lot of comments, public forum, the working group, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This year has been basically the year of taking it through both houses. And we began in this room, actually, on 7th of February, on briefing on the two bills to the Standing Committee. And so it's been quite a long process, and we're very glad we managed to get into your last meeting of the year. And then these are the pieces of legislation that you can expect going forward. Okay, so to go to the bill itself, its objects are to increase confidence in the South African financial markets, promote the protection of regulated persons and clients, reduce systemic risk, and promote international domestic competitiveness of security services. Now, these are basically the same as the Security Services Act. And we have to achieve that providing for an efficient and effective framework for supervision and for ensuring that financial stability is entrenched. And then finally, also to deal with investor and client protection, particularly market abuse. And so one of the things that we've done to the Security Services Act is tighten the requirements around insider trading. So there's a whole new chapter which strengthens the insider trading provisions and actually makes it more expensive to be caught for insider trading. So we've raised fines. So then I think it's quite useful for me just to take you through the chapters. And then I'm going to ask my colleague Petula to explain what we've done in each chapter, what amendments to the Security Services Act we've done in each chapter. So turning to the bill, structured in a very similar way to all of our legislation, including the Security Services Bill. Chapter 1 deals with the definitions and the objects of the Act. Chapter 2 deals with powers of the Minister, the Registrar, and the Deputy Registrar. The powers of the Minister have been subject to quite a lot of discussion in the Standing Committee, and we have introduced new sections which require the Minister to consult quite heavily before he exercises his power. We can have some discussion on that if you think it will be useful. But that has been one of the big issues coming out, is how do we balance the need for the Minister to be able to make regulations on matters related to financial markets, but that he doesn't, that he has to have a consultative process in doing that. So there is a new section which has never appeared in our legislation before, and it wasn't in the Security Services Act, which to some extent constrains the powers of the Minister, which I think is also quite good. Then Chapter 3 deals with basically the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, all the requirements that are in the law required for it to have. Many of these are direct from the Security Services Act. It deals with what are the licensing requirements for the JSE, how do they go about setting up their exchange rules, and so forth. And the functions of the bill, and then authorized users and general provisions relating to listed securities. Chapter 4 deals with what we call as the central securities depository. Now, just have to explain that this is different to an exchange. So what happens when you buy or sell a share is a lot like buying or selling a house. You buy and sell your house from an estate agent, but the record of you buying or selling the house is actually done by the deeds office. And in financial markets, it's exactly the same. You buy and sell shares on the exchange, but the record of the purchase is actually held at the Central Securities Depository, which in our system is a company called Strate. It used to be part of the JSC for a variety of reasons, because it's international-based practice. We've separated our two functions, but the Central Securities Depository has to have legal requirements applied to it. Then the bill introduces two new types of infrastructure to the system. It introduces a clearinghouse, which we've never had before, but is a requirement from the D20. And a clearinghouse, an independent clearinghouse, we've had associated clearinghouses before. An independent clearinghouse basically is a mechanism for risk in financial markets to be reduced. So particularly derivative trades need to be cleared through the clearinghouse, and then records of those trades need to be sent to what is called the trade repository. You could think about the clearinghouse to some extent sort of an exchange for derivatives, and the trade repository as being to some extent the same thing as the Central Securities Depository. But we've never had a framework for regulating derivatives before. And this has been a huge area of work in the G20, and it is a huge step forward in terms of our legislation to create an appropriate framework for derivatives regulation. So those are the two new pieces of infrastructure that have been introduced. And then looking at the bill, you'll see that basically the sections for the clearinghouse relate to the licensing requirements, the functions of the clearinghouse, and the rules that the clearinghouse may write, and not only the rules they have to create, but also what the rules must comply with. And then similarly, we've set out requirements for a trade repository. Those establish the four pieces of financial market infrastructure that you need to run a financial market: the exchange, the CSD, the clearinghouse, and the trade repository. But there are things that apply to all four of those, and those are all contained in Chapter 7 of the bill. So those are things around the annual assessment, which the registrar has to undertake, cancellation of the license, etc. So that is all dealt with in Chapter 7. In Chapter 8, we impose a code of conduct on everybody that is regulated in financial markets, also similarly to what has been created in the Securities Services Act, and it is a principle-based code of conduct. And that is to allow the registrar to ensure that individuals in the financial markets behave appropriately. Chapter 9 deals with nominees. Nominees are just a specific type of creature in the financial markets, which we, it's a bit short section. It's just, it relates to the approval of these nominees. And then, as I said, Chapter 10 deals with market abuse and insider trading provisions. It defines the offences that are related to insider trading, offences that can be regarded as need to be enforced. We need to have appropriate approaches to insider trading, prohibited trading practices. So those are things like if you manipulate the share price, then that is prohibited under the law, etc. And if you make false, misleading, or deceptive statements. Then there is obviously the sanctions relating to insider trading, procedural managers, matters, and the administration of the chapter and the general provisions. And then Chapter 9 deals with auditing provisions, who the auditor shall be, accounting records of audits, and the power of the registrar to request an audit. And then Chapter 12 is basically the general provisions that just allow us to administer the Act, relating specifically to the powers of the registrar to create on-site visits or inspections, penalties, and the referral to the Enforcement Committee. They're particularly around winding up registrars in curatorship, so specific provisions to align this piece of legislation to the Companies Act around business review, and then the final set of requirements, sections 104 to 112, are just the usual stuff, so things like the interpretation, the appeal, evidence, regulations, fees, offences and penalties, our transitional arrangements, we have to report the Security Services Act, and then a short title. So I don't know how much time we've got left, because we can go into a little bit more detail on some of these sections if it would help you.
10 minutes,
okay. So maybe Petula can just take us quickly through the specific major changes between the CIMS is. Four slides. Very quickly, just take you through the major changes that have taken place between the Security Services Act and the Financial Markets Act.
Okay. Looking at what the differences lie between the previous Security Services Act and the Financial Markets Act. So previously, the registrar's powers were detailed, but then the minister didn't have much power in terms of applying regulations. What's different is now that we've separated our chapter section 5 from section 6, so section 5 goes to the minister having explicit regulation making power, and it talks to how we can issue regulations for unlisted securities, which also links up to the G20 requirements for regulating OTC derivatives. We can also make regulations in terms of how outside entities may operate, and that just looks specifically at the external exchanges, external participants, external PSDs, clearing houses, clearing members, which are all defined in the bill, and also how entities that are regulated in any other legislation may be dealt with under the law. This is to bring all players that provide security services that aren't regulated to the net of the SMB. And also the registrar's powers have been expanded in terms of inspection of on-site visits and the enforcement committee, where it's established by the SMB Act, and then the regulator may also refer any contradictions to the enforcement committee. And then there is also no explicit consideration of systemic risk under the Security Services Act that's been addressed in the F&B, where now the minister and the registrar may talk to each other in terms of how they will deal with systemic risk. And there's also specific requirements for the financial market infrastructure to report any matters that may pose systemic risk to the registrar and the minister. And also there was no requirement for any kind of coordination between regulators. Now we're finding that there might be overlapping and issues that they may need to coordinate with. So the registrar must coordinate with the governor to monitor and mitigate systemic risk. And you may also negotiate and enter into any MOUs with other supervisory authorities, maybe not necessarily local here in South Africa, but they have a duty to inform the minister and governor on any matters that that may pose systemic risk to the country. Again, as Roy mentioned, that the SSA only provided for licensing and supervision of the exchange and the clearinghouse that had, where we have a very strong integrated model where we didn't have an independent clearinghouse, just an associated clearinghouse. But now we've extended this to provide for licensing and supervision for an independent clearinghouse that sort of also has some kind of SRO status, as well as a new entity that's the trade repository. That's not an SRO, but again, this is also to align with our G20 and IOSCO requirements. We have the SRO model has been retained. Okay, but then we also strengthened the conflict of interest and service provider provisions quite significantly. Again, you see that in Section 61, Section 62 that deal with the conflict of interest and for any market infrastructure carrying on additional business. The concept of financial market infrastructure was absent. We spoke mostly to the self-regulatory organization in the Security Services Act, but now just to separate out the regulatory powers from the finance, from the provision of financial services powers of the particular market infrastructure providers. We've defined a financial market infrastructure. Again, just to emphasize that the SRO model has been retained, it's just that now we no longer research it specifically. And you'll see that the general provisions that relates to market infrastructure under Chapter 7. And also the licensing of financial market infrastructure is subject to ministerial regulations, although we don't require local presence for the clearinghouse and the trade repository, but this may be required by the minister. The FSA was quiet on how external market players were able to participate in the South African financial market. However, now the minister has powers to prescribe regulations on how these entities may enter the South African market. The minister can also prescribe regulatory framework for OTC derivatives, which also falls under the unlisted securities. And also, where only market players that were defined in the regulations in the FSA could fall under the legislation, now that we've extended the scope to ensure that that they're full coverage. Now the minister has the powers to be a category of regulated person to be providing security services in South Africa, and also see that also is dealt with in the code of conduct, where it can provide code of conduct for regulated persons and for those entities that aren't previously regulated in any other law. And then we also have the financial stability. That's a policy priority for and the SSA, but also we've included new provisions to strengthen those, especially with regards to the securities intermediation and insolvency sections. You can see an example of that where now the CSD section deals with how to deal with statutory flagging and pitching and session of securities and procedures to follow in insolvency proceedings. And also we limited the powers relating to the insolvency settlement in the settlement chain in the SSA. Now these have been aligned with the UN Convention on Securities Intermediation. And we've also strengthened investor protection. Now we've, where previously there wasn't much provision for the segregation of assets, but now there is specific to the settlement system as well as the clearinghouse, and with the provisions have been strengthened that certain market infrastructure in the carrying on of the business need to separate the client's assets from their own business. In the SSA as well, when it comes to limited liability, they enjoyed that basis, but now that's been retained. However, it's been balanced on a strong accountability provisions, especially when it comes to additional business under Section 61 and the conflict of interest under Section 62. And again, just to align the legislation with the New Companies Act as well. As we mentioned again, there's much more coordination in the FNB for the regulators to cooperate when it comes to overlapping jurisdictions, specifically compared to the Consumer Protection Act under Section 36. And where previously there wasn't any direct authority for the registrar for international cooperation to become quite significant as we move to the OTC derivatives environment. Now the registrar can enter into memorandums of understanding with those authorities. And what also being included is that now, in addition to where the registrar could approve any mergers and takeover transactions, now the minister can approve any change in control that exceeds 49%, and you can see that in Section 67.5 of the SMB. Again, the code of conduct has been expanding to all regulated persons that previously had just been to market infrastructure. Now it includes all regulated persons which have been defined as including the members of those FMIs. And the insider trading and the market abuse provisions have been significantly strengthened as well. So I think that also ties up with the strengthening of the investor protection, the FMB. Okay.
Sorry, there was quite a lot of detail in there. It's a very big piece of legislation, but hopefully that gives the committee a sense of the changes that we have undertaken. The big issues, I think, to conclude, have been this changing of the market structure. And you talked a lot about SROs. And SRO is a self-regulatory organization, and that basically is the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, JSE, and the Central Securities Depository. This has been quite a big issue in terms of the bill. We've had a lot of input on it, even in the committees. And the bill has, as Sheila highlighted, taken quite a lot of steps to improve the SRO model. We don't think we're ready yet as a country to get rid of the SRO model, but it is important to highlight that the entities do play a role, both referee and player, and so we've committed to reviewing the role of these exchanges going forward. We've then also had a lot of discussion about the accommodation of something called an exchange light, and it was our view that it's not appropriate to introduce a exchange light. Because exchanges are so important in a system, we have to ensure that we don't have like light touch approaches to these exchanges. Then we've obviously, as I think she highlighted, expanded the scope of regulation. We've put in things to make the law more flexible because it's a very rapidly evolving, innovating system. And we've done many things in terms of preventing a crisis and containing a crisis and minimizing loss. Some of the issues have come up in terms of the role of the Reserve Bank, and so we've improved the role of the Reserve Bank in the bill, but we were doing more of that in subsequent legislation. And then we've done stuff to keep market participants honest in terms of curbing market abuse, and we've improved the way the laws interact with each other, particularly Companies Act and the Future legislation. So that hopefully covers enough, but I mean, it's quite a big piece of legislation, so we're really open to any questions that the committee might have. Yes.
Remember, are there any questions? Let me take your hands, Marco Bella. Can someone just pull all the list back because we must go right to adopt the report 7 minutes. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. We go to the page 57 on the bill, the market abuse. I'm just worried about the failure to give explicit sentences. For example, it's written, I'll start here. The insider who knows that he or she has inside information and who deals directly or indirectly or through an agent for his or her own account. All right, you know the information. They said, will be affected by it, commit an offense. I would love to see commit an offense and liable on conviction, trespass, exceeding, or on an option of a fine. Okay. That is section 78, last paragraph, the insider trading. Now, on 98, powers of court to declare person disqualified. Here's my problem here. That's saying, declare such concerned person can be disqualified for indefinite period or a period specified by the court. I'm just worried by the period specified by the court. It won't give a vague interpretation. If you can check the last paragraph on B, 98B, I'm just worried about this. Can they not say so many period because it may cause the magistrate or director to abuse their power? Thanks.
Thank you, person. I'm actually made to understand that with this piece of legislation, we are revealing or replacing the Security Services Bill.
Mm.
Is that correct? And now, if that is the case, I would like to know if there are any transitional arrangements. Well, surely we can say that things would have tied up exactly as we would have loved them. Under the current Security Services Act. Then there is this thing so-called the institutional arrangement, the institutional arrangement to be independent. And also I think they are hearing as well is the limited powers of the minister, other than just simply issuing regulations or whatever. What is the understanding of this independence? Are we putting together a piece of legislation subjectively or objectively? Then the other thing that I just wanted as a follow-up to that specific question is, when we say the minister has the power to issue regulations, in principle, what are we saying? Are we saying the department? Are we saying the ministry? And how does that tie up with the limitations of the powers of the minister in the actual implementation of the content of the piece of legislation? Then, because we are dealing with a very delicate situation which can actually take the country down at any time, if there is any misbehavior. But now we say the registrar can request information from any person. What about subpoenaing a person who may be refusing with the information or have some sort of let me say serious powers to subpoena a person to bring information and to explain anything that the registrar may not be happy about. Powers that cannot be any contact of. To ensure that this particular area it is clean from any misbehavior. And then there is this comment that says the minister should discuss heavily before takes decision. And then discuss heavily in whose understanding? Because I'm sure, Chair, you'll remember that certain pieces of legislation have been turned down by the Constitutional Court on the extent of public consultation. The manner in which Parliament thinks it has consulted people may not have the same interpretation in the court of law. Now the question is in whose understanding the minister would have heavily consulted before taking any particular decision. How can we clarify that, if there is any grey area about it? Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. you've explained to us the whole sequence of legislation in the pipeline, all interrelated. Does that mean that this is going to come back for amendment when the Twin Peaks model is implemented? Or does this take account of the other legislation which is going to come before us, which I'm not sure how I can until we've actually finalised that legislation. So are you anticipating that we're going to have to deal with this particular act if it becomes an act and when we deal with other legislation? The question of regulation I think is fairly well agreed to, but it seems from our point of view that there's a lack of promotion of the question of competition as well. I mean, this is a market. And so it needs to be regulated, we all agree, but it also needs to be competitive. The Honourable Mashila has touched on the question of regulations, maybe not just touched, but spoken on the question of regulations. And so we also hold some reservations that the regulations appear to be entirely in the hands of the minister, and there doesn't appear, and you can indicate if I'm wrong, provision for the signing off of at least some of the regulations by Parliament in as many forms. So if you could just clarify that for me. And then the question of independent assessments and potential conflicts of interest. Our view is that Section 62 should have been amended to provide for independent assessments of potential conflicts of interest within the market infrastructure. Your comment on that? I think you probably dealt with these in the Portfolio Committee, so you should be amply able to deal with them here, and perhaps give an answer that didn't satisfy my colleagues in the Portfolio Committee. A better answer. My apologies, Mr. Chairman.
We don't always get what we want to get. So, any other questions? Thank you, my response.
Thank you very much, Chair. Not sure I answered the right questions. I was going to answer clear reading services board questions, which I think would have taken us back to past. to begin with, section Honourable Mbakubele's question on section 78.1A relating to the silence on the offences. It's quite correct, obviously, that the section 7.1A is silent on how we deal with offences. But if I'm correct, I think section 109 lays out the way that section 109 sets out the specific liabilities that can be imposed in event of an offence under the legislation. It's important, actually, I didn't have to go into a lot of detail about the increase in the offences, which I think I might as well do now since it's come up. But what we've done in section, let me just find it, sorry. In section 82, what we've also done is we have introduced a new penalty for insider trading. So if you want to see where all the offences are located, they're both in section 109 and section 82. But section 82 is a bit of a change from the Securities Services Act. Previously, the Securities Services Act allowed us to fine an individual three times the gain that he had made from insider trading. So if you, for example, had done insider trade and you had made a profit of 50,000 rand, then the court and were able to fine you up to 150,000 rand. And that's been quite successful. We've actually had cases that have, where an individual has been found guilty of insider trading to the value in the hundreds of millions. The interesting problem, of course, is that some people are not only insider traders, but they're all the stupid. And so they lose money. They insider trade on information that they have, but they actually come out with no money, or they come out with a small loss. In that situation, if you strictly interpret the law, we should give the money back for the stupidity, because a fine can be three times the gain or loss made, actually just the gain. But I mean, if you had a really good lawyer, he would probably convince the court that they should give you money back. So what we've introduced is this new requirement, which is section 82.2B, which is an amount of up to 1 million to be published, adjusted by the registrar annually. So if you read it all together, 82.2, if you're caught contravening section 78, 4 and 5 of the Act, then you're liable to pay an administrative sanction not exceeding the equivalent of profit that you would have made or cost avoided, plus amount of up to 1 million. So that's a new penalty, just to make sure that we have some kind of a scope to address it. And that 1 million penalty, also one of the other issues we discovered in the Security Services Act, actually, and this was a suggestion, I think, from the Standing Committee, is that the Security Act, Services Act fines were set at a certain level, and that was about 6 or 7 years ago, and nowadays there actually isn't very much money. So now all the offences rise by inflation every year, so we will, the Act does allow for that. So hopefully that answers the question on that
the fine. Yes.
109.
Yeah.
It does provide for penalties or imprisonment.
Yeah.
But it doesn't provide for an option of deregistering an institution if it is misbehaving in the industry.
Yes.
Are we saying that all this cannot commit an offense which actually violates the actual principle of existence of that institution that it will warrant to be deregistered or delisted so that it doesn't operate anymore because it is actually...
Yeah.
Because the 109 doesn't provide that.
Yeah,
why shouldn't we add that?
I know for a fact that the rules of the exchange are that if you are caught, if you are found guilty of offense under the Old Security Services Act, then the exchange has the ability to deregister you as a member of the exchange. So that's contained in the rules. And if I am correct, I think we might have that power under the powers of the registrar. Let me just check. 98. I think that it's actually dealt with in section 98 on page 68, which if a court convicts an authorized user participant or member, blah, 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 the court may stop that person from carrying on business or being employed in a capacity of trust. So I think section 98 provides the court the ability. But definitely the JSC rules, and then I think in section 98. Hope that helps on that issue.
Not say that all these cases will actually test the horse. And then so if courts are not approached, but then these offenses are made.
Yes.
And they are dealt internally, especially in terms of 109. There is no provision that an action to deregister an institution which is not actually helping the sector is not provided.
Yeah, so that actually would explain that in terms of section 99, and then I asked Janine to also add to that.
Our legal lady will.
Because she's been doing quite a lot of work on this. There is an enforcement committee, which is an internal committee within the Financial Services Board, and that is created in both this piece of legislation and in the Financial Services Board legislation, and that is an administrative body that can take actions and include deregistering in terms of section 98. So Janine wants to add.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. It is actually appropriate to have the separation between Section 109 and 98, because Section 109 sort of deals strictly with the criminal aspects of the offenses and the penalties that can be imposed, and those would always end up being dealt with by a court, because all the criminal matters would end up being dealt with in a court. And so the Section 98 then sort of goes beyond provides the court in those serious matters, which have been already referred to, it provides those matters with an expanded power to also declare them disqualified. So the Section 109 is a type of provision that is included in many pieces of legislation wherever there are criminal offenses that are provided for. And then it's appropriate if you're going to provide additional powers of the court, which are not strictly considered to be particularly criminal, penal powers, but more additional sanctions or additional powers of the court, that those be provided for in the separate section. So in our view, the Section 98 and Section 109 together would provide the appropriate range of powers for the court in addressing those serious offenses, and would enable the court to both impose a serious fines or imprisonment, and also to declare entities to be disqualified. Thank you.
Given, any other responses?
No, I'm sorry, Chair. I'm looking through the section on exchange rules. I think it is required, I want it now, that the restraint does make rules with respect to people that have found been found guilty of either offences, either in the enforcement authority or through the court system. So I think it is dealt with through the rules, as Anne Stream has indicated, also appropriate differences between the two of them. I think that's enough.
Honourable members, are you correct? Any follow-ups?
None. Yes, I'm sorry. Transitional arrangements, we have provided for transitional arrangements in section 110 of the bill. Quite correctly, there will be a change of a period between when certain things are regulated under the Securities Services Act and the Financial Markets Act, and particularly with regard to licensing, registration, authorization. So if you look at section 110, the license, registration, or authorization of a regulated person, if you were licensed or registered under the Securities Act, then that license or registration flows through into the financial markets, hopefully by the Financial Markets Act, and similarly the rules, etc. And then there is also a sort of a catch-all phrase in section 110.5, which says that the registrar may, on or after the commencement of this Act, but prior to a date determined by the Minister on reasonable grounds, on application or on the registrar's initiative, provide for any additional transitional arrangements that may be required. And that's because we can't conceptualize all the possible changeover requirements that might be needed. And then obviously the Act will come into force on proclamation also, so that gives us a little bit of time to make sure that we have all the appropriate transitional arrangements in place. Yes, then a very good question which has come up quite a lot in the consultations, which is what do we understand by the powers of the Minister, particularly around the independence and limitedness. And then there was also another question, which is we said, the question was relating to, we say that the Minister must discuss heavily the proposed regulations with interested parties, or rather he must consult quite substantially with interested parties. And so we have actually set out in quite a lot of detail in section 107.2a the process that must be followed by the Minister. In terms of the making of regulations, and this was actually also introduced during the process. And so I think what the intention here is to provide a bit of a tick box approach so that if the regulations are called into question, we can prove or the court can decide whether or not the Minister has followed the process as set up in the legislation or consultation. And so it's actually quite prescriptive in terms of on the Minister in terms of what process he needs to follow to so. There was a related question about who exactly makes the regulations. Is it the Minister or the Treasury? The law and all our legislation, the Banks Act and the visa legislation and the Pension Funds Act, where the Minister's regulation-making powers, that requires the Minister's formal signature, but there's also a process before that has to be followed internally within the Treasury before it can be recommended to the Minister for signature. So there's both an internal process in the Treasury and then there's also a process set out in the legislation. And then also section 107.2.6, which is the last sentence on page 71. The Constitution allows or provides for Parliament to scrutinize legislation or subordinate legislation. Our interpretation is that the Constitution allows Parliament to scrutinize both legislation and subordinate legislation, and so we have actually required in the law that the Minister must submit the draft regulations to Parliament for parliamentary scrutiny at least 1 month before promulgation and final relations to be tabled also. I think Janine has been doing quite a lot of work with and the State Law Advisor, so maybe I should refer these sorts of very technical questions to them.
Well, just to briefly add, we did take cognizance during the public hearings process and the deliberations in the parliamentary committees about the concern and importance of appropriate oversight for parliament over subordinate legislation, and that is why we have particularly inserted the requirements both that the draft regulations would be submitted to parliament for consideration and scrutiny prior to them being finalized, and that also the tabled regulations would be also tabled in parliament. So then parliament would definitely have an important role in the oversight and the finalization of regulations that would be made, because we also recognize the importance of the content of the regulations and the regulation-making powers that are being granted in terms of the legislation. And we certainly, that is why we've set out very detailed consultation process in relation to the regulations to ensure that all the relevant important stakeholders would be involved in the process and would be able to make input in the process, and that there would be appropriate parliamentary oversight, in short, also. Thank you very much.
Lord Wise, do you want to come in?
Thank you, Chairperson. I can just add that with the concern that the minister can make regulations or abuse of the power that is given the legislation. There's no such that thing that could happen. There's no chance of happening in actual fact. He makes a regulation in terms of the act, and anything that he does or she does that is outside, that is regarded as outrageous, and there's no way that he can do that. So that is a sort of a quite regulated, and I also that doesn't want to touch on the question that the court it was mentioned by the honourable member that the court must also be sort of a it must be included that the court must impose certain penalties. I want to say that the separation of powers does not allow that. So the discretion of the court must be sort of be retained. So the courts are allowed to use they've got that inherent power of using their discretion. So it cannot be prescribed how they must deal with the cases, because cases are different. They must be treated on their merit. So it cannot be prescribed to court that they must impose this up to, they must not use their discretion. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Leif Makubela, the Grum.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The Regulation 107.286 doesn't make provision for consideration, simply for scrutiny. And so that remains our concern, and regulations, I'm afraid, are not simply a result of the Act. You know, devil's in the detail, and that's where the detail is in the regulations, very often. And so I would disagree with the state law advisor that the minister may not, he might not deliberately abuse it, but he may or she may well produce regulations which Parliament would find unacceptable, and even if they're in line with the Act in some way or other, or can somehow be justified. So our concern remains that the oversight of Parliament over the regulations, whilst there's a great deal of consultation, there's very little real oversight or determination, or no determination at all by Parliament in that process. Parliament, and that means you, those of us sitting here, we can make some submissions, and the minister may alter the draft regulation, not must. So that remains a concern. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I must say, in terms of Section 69 of the Constitution, describes oversight role of this committee, that means that the kicking of the machine.
Chair, I've got those two now. On Section 107, 2A, Roman Figure 1,
since the minister must ensure consultation with recognized industry body. Must ensure. I just need some reasonable clarity on this. That should recognized industry bodies not cooperate, everything stops. Does that mean that everything stops if these industry bodies don't cooperate? And then the section 107 provides for making regulations, draft regulations. Does it also mean for amending regulations? Is it the same section that will be used for the amendment of regulations? It's the same process. Those are the two issues that I just clarified.
Thanks, Chairperson. Man, it's a follow-up to the law advisor. during March, April, we had a case here in the Western Cape concerning, it was something of the sort, where there was no penalty clause indicated. Once the court did not come to their power and say, okay, we are not restricted, we cannot give, they came back to our to the parliament to come and make some amendments. We're sitting here and reading that case, I still remember. Thanks.
Right, you can respond to this. We might just look at the time of the member.
Just to respond quickly to a couple of the questions. In relation to ensuring consultation with recognized industry bodies, it would be, I think, incumbent upon the Minister and the National Treasury to ensure that there were efforts to consult. And if for whatever reason, certain of the industry bodies didn't decide that they were going to participate, I don't think then they would have failed to take up the opportunity to consult, to be consulted. I don't think that could delay the, or, you know, preclude regulations being finalized if they willingly chose not to engage in the process when their views were solicited on the regulations and their inputs were solicited. They couldn't just stonewall the process, I don't think. Then the minister could indicate to Parliament or to the public that yes, efforts were made to consult with these bodies, if they then raise issues about making regulations, but that they did not engage in the process. And then it would be clear that the minister would have fulfilled the obligations to consult. But if the other party is not willing to consult, then that did not preclude regulations being made. In relation to, if there were amendments to regulations that would be made, those would also follow the similar process to original regulations. They would be consulted upon, published, et cetera, as Section 107 would apply. In those instances also. Thank you. And also just to note, the term scrutiny, there was some discussion about that in the standing committee also. And scrutiny, it is a very broad term that does provide that there can be a stringent degree of oversight and provided by the committee. So it is a term that's meant to encompass all of the types of function, oversight functions that the committee would want to and Parliament would want to engage in relation to the regulation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Janine has dealt with all the questions related to Janine's advisors. Unless there are any follow-up questions on 107. Maybe just to add, I think, on 107-2A6. This was quite an intensive discussion, particularly around the very idea of subordinate legislation, which is to provide the executive with some flexibility within the constraints of the legislation. Just as a personal point, as you saw, it has taken us 4 years to get the bill to this point. We would be hesitant to have regulations following also a four-year process for approval. So I think one has to also bear in mind the practicalities of regulation versus legislation and the approval of Parliament, the processes involved. And so we have, I think, come to the correct conclusion, which is that we should allow parliamentary roles to scrutinize and to engage the minister on the regulation, but that there is a difference between legislation which is passed by parliament and subordinate legislation which is within the power of the minister, and it's quite constrained, I think, in terms of his role. Moving on then to the request for information from any person that the registrar might have. I think that's quite a good point. One of the issues that we've really found that we've struggled with, and this also relates to the earlier question, is that a legislation only applies to regulated persons. And then you have to prove that someone is undertaking unregulated business, and that might be subject to criminal sanction. That leaves quite a big grey area where somebody is undertaking a certain kind of business in financial markets which you might want to regulate. And we actually have instances of that at the moment. And so the legislation doesn't allow you to regulate it, but they're kind of breaking the legislation, but they're also not necessarily behaving badly. You just want to create a little bit of a framework for them to operate within. And so the bill actually has introduced some flexibility between the registrar and the minister, and it has to be a sort of a joint decision, to create additional categories of regulated persons under the regulations, which will, I think, improve that problem which we had. So I think that goes to both questions. I think that was from Honourable McWhirter, quite a good question, in terms of how do we ensure that the regulator can request information from any person that is within the law, but that he can actually do something with that information, and that's to create the process. I think if there's any follow-up questions on that one, I'll please check. Oh, yes, I'm not sure if that means where the subpoena powers are. Is that in the last section? Yeah. I think that power does it. I can't remember where it is. I think that is within the context of the powers of the court. I'm not sure if the registrar has actually got the powers to subpoena. It might have to be through the court process. But I'm sure we'll look through it, and I'm sure we'll be able to get back to you on that one. I think we talked about 197. Then the questions from Honourable Lees. Yes, quite correct. These all come up in the Standing Committee, and these were highlighted by the Honourable Shadow Minister of Finance in Parliament. Although, obviously, the Shadow Minister, National Assembly, the National Assembly did concur with the bill, but highlighted that we had agreed to disagree on a few topics. These are the topics we have agreed to disagree on. A sequence of legislation. This is a major crisis. No, this is an issue for the Treasury. We are in the middle of quite a thorough review of the legislation and the creation of Twin Peaks. We have other priorities in terms of just reaching our G20 commitments, which have to take priority. And so they are going for the Twin Peaks process, and the Twin Peaks legislation will only probably be ready during the course of next year, and knowing the parliamentary timetable, we'll probably pass them in early 2014, maybe late 2014. And so we have struggled ourselves with deciding how do we sequence things, and we have taken the decision to put through quite a lot of just sort of rats and mice amendments, so that you'll see in the Omnibus Bill, the Federal Service Bill, we have to do before Twin Peaks. And these things are things in the financial markets that have to be done before Twin Peaks. It is correct, however, that we will be making small amendments to the Financial Market Bill, what will then be the Financial Markets Act in the Twin Peaks legislation. We'll get back to this in a second. Then, yes, on the promotion of competition, the original draft of the bill and the objects of the Act, which is in Section 3, or Section 2, Section 2 of the bill originally said that the primary object of the Act was to promote competitiveness. It was a discussion in the Standing Committee if that was enough, and we agreed with the Standing Committee that we should extend that a little bit, so we have changed that to promote the internal and domestic competitiveness of the South African financial markets and of security services in the Republic. The Minister in the National Assembly did highlight that we felt that the explicit recognition of competition as an object of the Act would put our minister in conflict with his colleague, the Minister of Trade and Industry, because competition lies under the Competitions Act and would, as a result, create a bit of a strained overlap between the responsibilities of the Registrar of Security Services and the Competition Commissioner. And so we felt that it would be going a little bit too far to create competition as an objective of the Act, but competitiveness would be enough. I guess it is a compromise, but I think it's very important, particularly for regulation, that you don't create two conflicting pieces of legislation for a regulated person. So if they are engaging in anti-competitive behavior, who takes action? Is it the Financial Services Board or is it the Competition Commission? You can see a world where the regulated person gets attacked from two different regulators for the same offense, but that there are two different processes that they will have to follow. So it's very important that we separate out the distinctive powers. And as highlighted by the Minister in Parliament and National Assembly, that's the Treasury's view on that. I think that we have dealt with... there is also a new addition, which is in Section 5 of the bill, which is also in Section 6, which is that the Minister must take into account the object of the Act as a principle that competition between regulated persons should not be impeded or distorted, which is also in response to that concern. And then there was a concern about independence in the Section 62, that this should not be a self-assessment. I think there was an early draft bill said that the annual assessment must be a self-assessment. However, the new draft, following discussion with the standing committee, is that it is 62B, that is the manner prescribed by the registrar. So I think we've provided some clarity there. And then just to go, sorry, to the original question around subpoena, 94.1.1 sets out the processes the registrar needs to follow in order to obtain information. And also that's also as being highlighted in Section 95. So I think that covers that. I think that's all the questions.
Honourable members, having received this presentation on both bills, I'm putting to you, to the committee, our report that will go to the House. Welcome, Honourable Montisi. I know it's hectic in the space until next week and the 4th of December. Everyone's running between meetings. It's like sausage and meat in a sausage machine. They're just pumping it in. Other members, I put to you the report of the Select Committee for Finance on the Credit Ratings Bill, HB 12, Section 75, dated 21st of November 2012. The Select Committee on Finance, having considered the Credit Rating Services Bill, HB 12, Section 75, referred to it and specified by the Joint Tacking Mechanism as a Section 75 bill, report that it has agreed to the bill without amendment. I put this to the committee.
Yes, Chair, I move for the adoption of this document.
A second one?
I'm happy about it.
Thank you very much. We will sign that. Then the second one is the report of the Select Committee on Finance on the Financial Markets Bill, E12B12, Section 75, dated 21 November 2012. The Select Committee on Finance, having considered the Financial Markets Bill, B12B12, Section 75, referred to it and classified by the Joint Acting Mechanism as a Section 75 bill, reports to it that it has agreed to the bill without amendments. I just want to note that the concerns that was mentioned here will be captured in our minutes, and when I do the statement, I will also refer to it. I put this to the committee. The bus is like the MF of beer for me. There's a motion for the adoption of Honourable Mashinga, a seconder. Can we get a seconder? Honourable Makubela. Thank you, all the members. That deals with the legislation part. Thank the team from Treasury to come and brief us. We're going into the second phase now, nearly, of our meeting, dealing with the minutes, administrative issues. And then we'll have a short break before we deal with the ministerial task team on the popo. So we won't keep you. You are welcome to stay, but you are released. Which is on the members, that brings us to the minutes of previous meetings. I just want to get my documentation. There it is. Just see to it, members, that you have your minutes in front of you. We're starting with the minutes of the 13th of September. In actual fact, that's my wife's birthday, so it was a good day. Thursday, the 13th of September, the minutes. I'll put you on page 1. Who's present, absent, staff, etc., page 2. This report will also serve before the House between tomorrow and next week. Can we get in proposal? Honourable Mashile? Proposal adoption? Or are there corrections? Adopted and seconded. That takes us to the meeting on the members of the 26th of October. That's on the MTBBS. It was a briefing by the Minister of Finance and his team on the medium-term budget policy statement. Page 1. Yeah, please. Do we have Honourable Magabella? Moses is also here. Page 2, Honourable members. The report we already adopted. A mover for adoption. A seconder. Thank you. We just want to minute it correctly. Then the minutes, honorable members, of the 30th of October. It was a public hearing jointly with the Standing Committee on Finance on the revised fiscal framework. That was the input by different stakeholders. I put you page 1. And then page 2. That was the different organizations that appeared before us. Can I get the mover for adoption? Honorable Mashila, moves for adoption. Seconder, Honorable Becker. Thank you, Honorable Becker. Next one is the meeting of the 31st of October, also jointly with the Standing Committee on Finance, referring to the report on the revised fiscal framework. Page 1. Page 2. There's a motion for adoption by Honourable Makubela and Honourable Mashile. Second that one. Thank you, honourable members. That takes us to the second last one, 13th of November, when the Northern Cape Department of COCA and the MEC for that department appeared before the committee, North West and Free State Makala there twice. I put you page 1 of the minutes of 13 November. It was very well attended. Faith, excuse me, but was made to be a friend. I apologize. The honorable member phoned me or sent me SMS. I can still remember. Page 2. Motion for adoption, seconded. Friday, 16 November, when we talked with the every first Friday, which is a call for. Okay. But not yet. I've just been given the last. I put to you page 1 of the 16th of November, all the members.
Of the rules of the institute.